We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Plenty to cover on this very nice day with the friggin' marathon in town. I'm glad you both made it.
The Aurora Bridge is closed. That's our only traffic update for this year on this radio show.
Yeah.
Because the city didn't really tell anybody it was going to be closed.
Promises, promises. All right, well, and speaking of closed, you have, Job, you have some news about the tenants union.
Yeah, bad news from the Seattle Tenants Union. This 32-year-old union is losing its county funding this coming week on July 1st due to the budget cutbacks we've all been hearing about. And they may be closing their doors. They aren't entirely dependent on county funding, but enough of their money in their annual budget comes from county funding that it's a pretty significant chunk to try and make up. If they're going to close their doors on July 16th, if they don't raise $25,000 by then, and at least as of the last I'd heard this past week, they'd only raised about $3,000 of that. So it's looking pretty grim. There's a group called Solid Ground that does do some assistance for tenants in rental properties needing legal help or needing help mediating with their landlords or just knowing their rights under the law for tenants. And also as an advocacy group, there really isn't anybody who's pushing Olympia to try and expand tenant rights beyond Seattle to some of the areas in King County and the rest of the state. The tenants union really has played an invaluable role in the community over the last three decades or so. So it's grim news, but if they can keep their doors open, they will try their best to. So if folks want to help out, you can certainly go to the tenants union website and donate.
Yeah, it seems like $25,000 is such a small amount for, you know, a good organization like that.
Yeah, given the work that they do and the invaluable role that they play in the community, it's number one, it's remarkable how much they do on so little money. But above and beyond that, it seems very penny-wise and pound-foolish in terms of the county's cutbacks.
All right. Well, moving on from that bad news to bad news about the air we breathe.
Yeah, the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency this week released an analysis of air quality and cancer risks in the Puget Sound area. And what they found is that most neighborhoods in Puget Sound have cancer risks that are 5.5 times higher than the national average for people who are just breathing the air. In areas close to freeways, ports, or industrial areas, the risk is some 27 times higher than the national average. And the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency's report is based on data in the EPA's National Air Toxics Assessment, which was also released this week. And that was based on 2002 emissions of 80 cancer-causing air pollutants. The Puget Sound the PSCAA's analysis also included diesel fumes, which was not included in the EPA's analysis. Of course, things have changed a little bit since 2002. We've had more traffic, more large trucks and ships at the port, including more cruise ships, and more planes taking off and landing at SeaTac's third runway. But also some other things have changed for the better, too. Low sulfur diesel fuel was hit the market in 2006, and then 2007 saw tighter standards for new diesel-powered trucks and buses, but old diesel-powered trucks and buses are still out there on the streets. So there's plenty more that needs to be done, and it really is an important issue to try to clean up the Puget Sound air quality because, you know, I mean, we've been seeing increased rates of people with lung cancer who are non-smokers and have no real risk for it, no real risk factor for it, especially among women. And I think this probably accounts for a lot of that.
Kind of wondering there if what Job just coughed up was related.
I thought it was appropriate that I'd be, you know, coughing my lungs out during talk about air quality.
Air quality does affect people who have problems with their lungs, asthmatics, or people who, like Job, have issues with their immune system.
I've just got a bad cold.
Right. Yeah, but you know, it doesn't help you get any better if you have to breathe dirty air.
Of course it doesn't. And the fact is that and we'll talk about this when we get to healthcare, that, you know, healthcare in urban areas is made a lot more complicated by this.
Yeah, and you know, they've found too in studies that poor air quality contributes to things like heart disease and other illnesses as well as cancer.
It's not just lung stuff.
Yeah, so it's not just cancer that you have to worry about.
All right, moving on. It's looking like we might have a dam near us that appears to be leaking.
Yeah, the Army Corps of Engineers warned on Tuesday that the Howard Hanson Dam is leaking a lot more than they expected, and that it's bad enough that they may have to restrict the amount of water that the dam holds this fall and winter when the rains begin. The Howard Hanson Dam is 32 miles upstream from Auburn on the Green River, and this announcement means that there will be an increased risk of flooding for Kent, Renton, Auburn, and Tukwila if the rains are heavy this year. And in future years as well, because although the Army Corps of Engineers is spending some $20 million to try to fix the leaks, it's only going to be a temporary fix, and they still won't be able to let the reservoir levels go up very high. They'll still have to keep passing water through the dam in higher amounts than in previous years, and that's going to continue for several years into the future until they find a more permanent solution.
What sort of dam is the Howard Hanson Dam?
I don't know. I don't have
because
the statistics
I'm
on
having
that.
These visions of some of those earthen dams that have just had, you know, catastrophic collapses when...
Well, that's a risk. That's why they're not going to allow the reservoir levels to go up, because they're worried about a catastrophic failure, which would be even worse than the risk of flooding. Of course, the whole Green River Valley used to be a mix of farmlands and wetlands before 1961 when the dam was built.
Because it's floodplain.
Because it's a floodplain, yeah. And so we may see it return to some of that in the years ahead. So just a little warning there for the people of Kent, Auburn, Tukwila, and Renton.
All right.
And, of course, all those warehouses out there and strip malls, et cetera, and row houses that have been built on the floodplain.
Well, I think it'd actually be a lot more convenient for shoppers to have the South Center Mall somewhere in the middle of Lake Washington.
Yeah. You go by boat. It'd be kind of an interesting excursion.
Acres and acres of free submerged parking.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, it looks like the Navy wants a new facility to load its nuclear missiles.
Yeah, speaking of submerging, the Navy has put a proposal out very quietly to expand and build a second wharf at the Bangor Nuclear Subbase in Kitsap County to unload and offload nuclear weapons from the Trident nuclear submarines. Now, this is coming at a time a year before the Obama administration is scheduled to conduct a nuclear posture review, which will determine whether any of these nuclear weapons are actually necessary in Kitsap County at all. As it is, it's the largest repository in the United States for nuclear weaponry, and the Navy is, by doing this, is proposing to double its capacity to handle nuclear weapons and presumably combat the Soviet menace. There are a number of problems with this proposal, not the least of which is that the Navy has been very circumspect about releasing details. There were scoping hearings this week, one in Kitsap County and another that was moved at the last minute in downtown Seattle because they didn't want to have any protesters there. Well, they did anyway because the protesters found out, but it basically came off like a maneuver to evade the public. The Navy has not released any details as to cost. They have not released any of the actual plans for this wharf. The scale of the project we're talking about, though, is hundreds of millions of dollars. In environmentally sensitive Hood Canal, the environmental community is up in arms around this because of the danger it would pose to marine life in Hood Canal, which is already stressed and challenged by any number of different factors. But above and beyond this, it's an enormous waste of taxpayer money, given that it's not really necessary from any kind of military or strategic standpoint. So that's something we'll be keeping an eye on as the Navy presumably releases details on this in the months to come.
All right. Moving on, a update on the Minuteman situation, not to be confused with the Minuteman nuclear missiles.
No. Although both of them have, you know, the stated goal of, you know, trying to destroy people with darker skin color. But anyway, the murders in Arivaca, Arizona, of a Mexican-American man and his 9-year-old daughter during what was apparently a home invasion robbery last month by three members of an offshoot of the Minutemen militia group that takes their gun fetish and uses it to patrol the border of Arizona and Mexico. More and more details are coming out about Shauna Ford, the leader of this offshoot group, who is accused in the murders, and some of her followers. And it's kind of been very interesting to see that, you know, the media coverage of this is not calling it what it clearly is, which is a hate crime. That these folks, both the man and his daughter, were targeted by Ford and her colleagues, because, at least according to authority, they had hoped to rob the house, and find both drugs and money that they would use to fuel their vigilante operations, and then they wound up wanting to kill the witnesses. Apparently, this is not the first time that this group has used a home invasion tactic, that they had perpetrated similar robberies, or suspected anyway, of perpetrating similar robberies in California in the past, and details are coming out of the nature of the group, such as, you know, members having to take an oath not to eat Mexican food, that really seems to have nothing to do with you know, stopping illegal immigration, and everything to do with xenophobia and fear and racism toward Mexicans and Mexican Americans. And the fact that this hasn't gotten nearly as much media attention as, you know, nationally, I'm talking about, as, for example, the shooting at the Holocaust Museum, or the murder of Dr. Tiller, even though you have basically the same dynamic of, you know, right-wing lunatics being fueled in their obsessions, you know, by racism and by a lot of the hate speech that circulates in the right-wing echo chamber. It really needs to be called what it is, and it's pretty alarming that you're seeing this not just on a national scale, but from people from this area.
All right. Moving on to national and the health care debate that's making the airwaves.
Yes, the health care bill has not passed the House yet, but the Senate, as we talked about last week, the House version was introduced, and it was kind of a wimpy bill that was a wish list that didn't have any kind of provisions on how to pay for the wish list, and that the focus is now on the Senate bill, which is has senators scrambling to try to figure out how to pay for it, and is also developing into a fight over whether or not to have a government plan. That's been a non-starter in the Senate so far. One Democratic senator, Kent Conrad, suggested a co-op plan, and that is starting to gain traction. The idea behind that is to create state or regional entities that would sell insurance to small businesses and individuals who would then become members of a co-op.
You know, Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, more like group health. The co-op would then negotiate rates with healthcare providers, or could employ their own doctors the way group health does. You have to point out that half of all, as Job just kind of mentioned, half of all insured Americans have their coverage from nonprofit insurers, but the costs are really no different between those nonprofit insurers and private insurance companies.
And more to the point, the nonprofit insurers operate exactly the same way in terms of their greed and their denial of care and their coverage.
Exactly. And proponents say, though, that the difference would be the collective ownership model, that because individuals and businesses that buy health insurance through a co-op would then be allowed to vote and be given ownership, that then they would oversee the operations of the co-op more closely. I'm not at all convinced that that's true. Group Health does operate on that collective ownership model, but you know, their rates are the same as any other private insurer, and the quality of care is not always considered as good as some private insurance companies and private care providers that you go to. So the main thing to point out is that the Senate is moving in a direction where they would be giving up the federal government single payer model, which means giving up the biggest way to control costs, which is the power of government to regulate fees and to regulate how physicians are paid, et cetera.
Yeah. Let's be clear about that. They're not just giving up the single payer model, because that's not even on the table at any point during these negotiations. They're giving up any sort of public option at all.
Yeah.
And there was a poll done this week by EBRI, which is a conservative business research organization, that says there's 83% public support work for some sort of public option, which really tells you how much of a public disconnect there is between public sentiment and what's being considered in lobbyist-infested Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Republicans, who have been pretty much the party of no on this health care debate, they really haven't come up with their own plan. This week, finally fixed that. The Republicans in both the Senate and the House put out their own plan. The Republicans, and I love this, in the Senate, had the Preserving Access to Targeted Individuals and Effective New Treatments and Services Act of 2009. That's right, the acronym is PATIENTS Act of 2009. They put more effort, I think, into trying to come up with the acronym than they did into actually fleshing out the details. The new bill actually would prohibit Medicare or Medicaid from using comparative effectiveness research to deny coverage. In other words, the one single simplest fix for any of the healthcare reform, which is to actually encourage the existing public agencies to only use treatments that work, that's being opposed by the Republicans. Meanwhile, House Republicans in the House presented a four-page outline of their health care plan on Wednesday, but said, and this is a direct quote from Roll Call, they didn't know how much it would cost, how they would pay for it, or how many of the nearly 50 million Americans without insurance would be covered by it. Which means, in other words, they don't have a plan.
Yeah, so all of the House bills so far have just been sort of, this is what we want, we'll leave it up to the Senate to figure out how to actually make it work.
Or how to pay for it.
Yeah, or how to pay for it. And also this week, the Obama administration announced a prescription drug deal with pharmaceutical companies to cut the costs of drugs for senior citizens who fall into the donut hole Medicare gap. That's senior citizens who have drug or prescription costs that fall between $2,700 and $6,100 per year.
Or disabled also, because I also get that.
Yeah, who are also on Medicare. That those folks will get a 50% off the medicines they have to buy out of their pockets with these big pharmaceutical companies. But folks who are advocates for senior citizens and the poor quickly pointed out that drug companies could really benefit from this new deal because it might make it possible for senior citizens and other folks on Medicare to switch from generic drugs now to brand name drugs. If the brand name drugs now fall within about the same price range. So prescription drug companies, by giving folks a bit of a discount, are probably going to see increased business because of this bill.
There's also the dynamic, which anybody who does any shopping is familiar with, of the drug companies, going ahead and doubling their prices and then offering the 50% discount
exactly.
on the public option, which is... not that they've never doubled their prices before.
Or offering the 50% discount for a short time and then upping the price.
Yeah, particularly on drugs that are require physical dependency or require ongoing usage.
Mm-hmm.
I like the whole concept of MSRP, manufacturer suggested retail price that they like to trot out there on any major product on the market. You're saving off the manufactured suggested retail price? Oh.
Yes. Sales. I'm just imagining the same sort of hard sale that some car dealerships use, where you come in and negotiate the price and come out wondering how it is that you're negotiating to paying it twice as much as you thought you were going to.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right. Anything else on healthcare related?
Yeah. The Federal Trade Commission announced on Tuesday that patients, insurance companies, and the federal government all pay an extra $3.5 billion every year for prescription drugs. And why is that? Because pharmaceutical companies pay generic producers to not make generic versions of certain drugs. This is called, they're called pay-for-delay settlements as part of patent lawsuits that are settled in court. And the first one really was negotiated in 1994 when Bristol-Myers Squibb paid Shine Pharmaceuticals to delay sale of a generic version of the anti-anxiety drug Buspar. It's become a big deal now for these big pharmaceutical companies to enter into these pay-for-delay settlements with generic companies, with generic drug companies, and pay the generic drug manufacturers a little bit of money in order to get them to delay the release of a generic version of a brand-name drug so that the pharmaceutical company can collect millions.
And how much do you want to bet that there's also private cases that don't involve lawsuits where the companies are also paying
generic
drug makers?
Also doing the same thing.
Not even to research how to make the generic versions. And because that's not a lawsuit, it's not part of the public record, so we don't even know what's happening.
Yeah, we don't know. And the Federal Trade Commission is urging Congress, really urging Congress, to pass a bill that would make such settlements illegal and such activity illegal.
Boy, it'd be interesting to track how much money gets is going out there for pay for delay.
Well, the Federal Trade Commission says, as far as they can tell, it's $3.5 billion a year, but it could be more.
Yeah, I could imagine that.
That's a fair amount.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Anything else on healthcare?
No, let's move on.
Well, we have food safety. Does that fall into the category, yeah, or is that separate?
Sure, we'll include food
safety.
Yeah,
an interesting tidbit this week on the E. coli cookie dough outbreak with Nestle
funny.
Toll House cookies, and a number of people were infected in 29 different states by contaminated frozen cookie dough. It turns out that Nestle was refusing to show records to the FDA during FDA inspections of their plant at which these at which the cookie dough was made, and the FDA was just fine with that, and is just fine with that. According to a spokesman, quote, companies have the right to make conditions on what they will or will not permit during an inspection.
Which That's not an inspection.
Raises the question of what's the point?
Yeah.
And this really underscores the idea that you can have and you need to have, and some people are finally talking about, all the necessary reforms that are needed in the food safety arena. But if those laws that are on the books are not being enforced, as they almost universally were not during the Bush administration, which is when these inspections happened, or during the Obama administration, when the FDA is defending what it did during the Bush administration, if you have those laws on the books, it doesn't mean anything. You still have to enforce the laws that we already have.
And the FDA is not doing that.
All right. Moving on, talk about the global warming bill.
Yeah, a global warming bill passed the House. It's unclear if it will even come to the floor in the Senate, but it's a cap and trade bill, and it's a very, very watered down version of the bill that was initially proposed.
And cap and trade, in turn, is a watered down version of a carbon tax or something that would actually be
that
effective.
Would actually be effective. Yeah, folks know the way that cap and trade works. Probably that the government sets a limit on emissions, issues permits for producing emissions up to that level, and then hands out those permits to certain industries, which can then and the companies within those industries can then buy and sell or trade their permits on a regulated market. That's how cap and trade works. And then as each year passes, the permits become more and more restrictive in order to impose the emissions limits.
Which sets up an interesting futures markets and on pollution credits.
Yeah, which sets up a whole new derivatives market gambling on, you know, what the price of
toxic waste
emissions permits will be, et
clean
cetera.
Air.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting back to our first story.
Exactly. And but the bill itself, it would require 15% of the U.S.'s energy be produced by renewable sources by the year 2020, and it would reduce emissions by 17% by the year 2020 and 83% by the year 2050, which is really not good enough. It is not fast enough.
Yeah, it's trying to close the door after not only the horse but all the animals are out.
Yeah. And in addition, in this bill, 60% of the permits for emissions production would go to the business community, which is far more than the environmental groups had initially requested. And it's kind of telling that most environmental groups have condemned this as a bad bill and had urged senators to vote urged House members to vote against it. But I think what was even most interesting about it was that the bill includes some exemptions for the agricultural industry. The EPA, for 5 years, will refrain from including the conversion of forests to cropland when it calculates how ethanol production contributes to global warming. This is a direct gift. It's a direct gift to the ag lobby.
And it's basically like saying we're going to calculate what the rates of lung cancer among smokers as long as we don't include people who use cigarettes.
Who actually use cigarettes, yeah. So, I mean, it was a bad bill. Of course, the Obama administration pushed really hard to get this bill to pass because they want something they can show the European Union before they head to Copenhagen in December to renegotiate a global climate treaty.
Yeah, that's the next round for Kyoto.
All right. That moves us on then to international and Iran.
Yeah, a grim week for protesters in Iran. The crackdown continued, and it's becoming increasingly clear that this is going to be a long-term struggle in terms of the folks within Iran that want to challenge the legitimacy of the regime. And also, it has become very clear that this is an internal fight within the Guardian Council among a number of the different ruling factions. And there's not just two. You hear mostly about, you know, reformers versus hardliners, but there's ethnic divisions, there's ideological divisions, there's personal schisms and history involved. So there's a lot of, and none of this is transparent at all. So a lot of people in the West and among observers of Iran in the Middle East are kind of scratching their heads at what the internal dynamic is that's going on. We simply don't know. What we do know is that the police and the Basiji are cracking down on protesters, and that a lot of the movement has been driven underground in the last week, which does not bode well for the short term for Iran.
All right, and very briefly, Somalia.
Yeah, the U.S. government announced this week that they have sent weapons to the Somali government. The government of Somalia has declared a state of emergency and asked for foreign intervention because the rebel movement, which is seeking to take over the government and impose Sharia law, has gained control of most of the south of the country and most of the capital city, except for a few blocks of Mogadishu.
And let's be clear that this quote-unquote rebel forces actually did have control of the country 3 years ago before the United States, through its proxy in Ethiopia, came in and overthrew it because of the U.S. alarm over an Islamist government in Africa.
Mm-hmm. And I should also point out, too, that in March, Osama bin Laden released a videotape calling for global jihad, including Somalia, and telling his followers that they should go to Somalia and help the Muslim rebels retake the country. And since that time, the rebels have retaken much of the country. And so now the Obama administration is jumping in there and carrying the fight against Muslim fundamentalism to the nation of Somalia. So and I also should probably point out too that it's not as if these rebel guys are any great shakes either. This week they staged a little public ceremony where they took guys who were suspected of being thieves out into a public square, chopped off their arms and legs, and paraded the arms and legs through the city. So
swell guys.
Yeah, so swell.
Emphasis on guys.
Exactly.
All right, events for this week.
One major one, Gay Pride, coming up tomorrow, starting 11 o'clock downtown. We understand there's a marathon this morning. We won't complain about the traffic again. And this is the last week of Eat the State Spring Fund Drive because, of course, it's no longer spring. So anything folks can do to help out with that would be greatly appreciated.
Please help us not turn it into a summer fund drive.
No, we're very close to our goal. We only need a few hundred more dollars to push us over the top. So anything you can do to help, it's the PayPal button at eatthestate.org or P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145.
Oh, I'm sure there's some people that say you're over the top already.
All right. quite possibly.
Talking, as we do every week, with Jeff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's found wherever you find free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, King County Library Shop, your dentist waiting room, anything like that. You can also find us on the web, our current and all of our past issues at www.eatthestate.org. We're going through a series of stories on the various primary candidates for the election coming up in August that most people know absolutely nothing about any of the people who are running. So, and I think this issue is a particularly good issue. It has an email from Iran, which I mentioned last week, and a number of other very good pieces. So check it out, www.eatthestate.org. And as we mentioned, any donations help too. And if you have comments, questions, tips, any feedback on the show, email us at info@eatthestate.org.